Hi, this is Katie Day and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women over 50 across the globe. You don't have to be a Mother Teresa to make an impact in the world. Sometimes it's the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry and they will always inspire you. Today I'm speaking with Frances Horn. Frances is an amazing hairstylist, I know this because she's mine, with an amazing story. She has been back in the UK for nearly 9 years now, but before that she lived in Kuwait and was married to a Kuwaiti. Frances has an amazing story about her time there and leaving the country and the region to return to the UK. Her business is called Noble Hair Design. That's because Noble was Frances's maiden name and she believes that all hair should be noble. She also has a really interesting story about her maiden name, which I'll chat to her about later. So Frances, thank you very much for giving up your time to speak to me. Normally I'm the one in the chair doing all the talking as you're fiddling with my hair. So this is a bit of a change around.
I'm in the chair.
You're in the chair.
And I'm
and I'm chatting to you. Yeah, don't ask that. I can do a lot of things, but cutting hair isn't one of them. So tell me more about your time in Kuwait. I mean, you said that you got married and the next day flew to Kuwait. I mean, heavens to Betsy, that must have been a shock to the system. How did all of that happen?
Yes, I met my first husband in 1976 in this technical college because he was doing chemical engineering and I was doing hairdressing. And we went out for the number of years till 1980 and it was, right, get on the plane with me, please. Oh, well, it wasn't like that, but... And we got married on the Wednesday. On Thursday, we went to Petit France to change my name and get me a different passport. And then flew out on the Friday to Kuwait.
Wow.
Yes. Nobody came to my wedding. It was nothing like that. Yeah.
I mean, had you ever been to Kuwait before?
No.
Wow. So what was your reaction when you stepped off the plane?
It was in January, so it wasn't too hot, but I noticed it was very dusty, and I remember my mother-in-law's house, we sat in these chairs, these settees, and I looked on the floor and thought, gosh, she just hasn't done much cleaning. There was this fine dust everywhere. But I got to realise after I was there for a few years that this fine dust comes in even if you've got the best windows.
Wow. Yes. Had you met any of his family before?
No. I'd met a friend, but I hadn't met any of his family before. And I couldn't speak Arabic at the time.
Goodness me. Yeah. How did they receive you? I mean, did they want their son to have married a
Middle Eastern? His first cousin.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so I came. And it was fine. Yeah, I was different, but they welcomed me there.
But they accepted you.
Yeah.
It was okay. Could they speak English?
No. So his brother could.
How did that work for a while?
I just learned to speak Arabic in the way that I said to him, how do you say such and such? And he'd tell me and I'd write it down phonetically.
Okay.
And then I was able to speak it. But I started to work within about 3 months in a local salon, a hair salon there, an Arabic salon.
Did you really?
Yes, and so I learned Arabic there in the salon, really.
Wow.
Doing all this long Arabic hair. And we had Marcel waving irons, which were heated up in this little machine, and we had to straighten hair. So it's before the age of the straighteners nowadays. And these were so hot that you had to test them on a piece of tissue paper, and if they burnt the tissue paper, they were too hot for the hair. But a number of times I saw hair being really burnt off, literally. But the Arabic hair could take it. It straightened
really?
The hair and made lots of little cuts. Yeah, they went out.
So what's the difference then between Arabic hair and Western
hair? Very coarse, but very strong.
So, oh, gosh.
Yeah. Okay. But they used to pin their hair up after you'd straightened it all or curled it. Each section you did, you had to pin it to their head because they'd then put their headscarf over it and leave the salon so that no one could see their
hair. Okay.
Husband's eyes only.
Indeed. Yeah. And it's still the same, of course. Yes. So, I mean, but to learn a language particularly with the job that you do, because it's so personal, you need to know the nuances of a language. So how long did it take you to pick that up?
I can't say I was very good at Arabic, but I got by. I could get by in talking to people, and it between the Arabic and the bits of English that people knew, it was fine. I could barter in the shops. I could talk to my mother-in-law and sister-in-law and understand what people said more than I could actually speak it, because I didn't go and learn it anywhere.
Can you read it?
No, I can't read it. I can't write it. No.
Right. So it was just the conversation.
Just the conversation. Yeah.
Wow. And how did you cope with the whole cultural shift?
I think when you're 19, you go to these places and you're open to adventure. I'm the sort of person that's very free spirit and wants to, you know, I wasn't daunted by anything. I think the most difficult thing, which I think people nowadays wouldn't realise, was the fact that communications were so much different.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have Facebook, you didn't have anything like that. So for me to talk to my mum and dad or have any support, it was a big trip down to Kuwait City to the telecommunications place with a, you know, lining up for the telephone in the telephone booth for X amount of minutes. And then, you know, hearing beep, 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 oh, more money, you know, quickly more money. And, oh, husband's waiting outside. Oh, gosh, hurry up, look, get home again. Can I do that again next week? No, I'm too busy. Oh, dear. Right.
Because we take it for granted, don't we, so much now. Mobile phones, the internet, Skype, emailing each other. I mean, you know, we're similar age. I'm a few years older than you. But, you know, I can remember when I started working in London, if the train was cancelled, was having to queue up outside a red telephone box to phone to say, whereas, and you forget, it's not that long ago, but we just take the global communication for granted now, don't we? We forget it hasn't always been like that. Amazing.
Skyping people, it's incredible. You see a picture of them, you can talk.
I know.
My son took me around the house with his Skype thing. You know, wherever you are in the world, you can
incredible. What was your parents' reaction?
Oh, my mum cried buckets.
Oh, I bet she did. Yes. Was she worried for you?
Oh, yes. My dad took my ex-husband into the drawing room and said, to look after her, you're to look, you know, and gave him a bit of a stern talking to. I went up to the bedroom and kind of like laid on the floor with my ear to the floor, trying to listen to what my dad was going to say to my, you know, proposed husband. And my mum was really upset. My dad was upset, but he didn't really show it. But my mum said to me, yes, he was really upset when you went.
I bet he was, because they didn't. I mean, talk about flying into the unknown. They had no idea if you were going to be safe or.
It's good life. It's good to do that. Fly into the unknown.
Well, and I mean, I've done it a few times in my life, you know, metaphorically and literally, but I haven't actually been married to somebody who I've done it.
In 1980, we didn't know what we know now, do we?
No, and sometimes that's a good thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it was an adventure.
How long were you there?
27 years.
Wow. That's a long time. Mm. Did you see a huge change in the Middle East in those 27
definitely.
Years?
When I arrived there, the road our house was on, and our house was owned by his father, and but it was in the name of my ex-husband and his brother. And it was on a road which was just a tarmac strip. If you go back and look at it now, it's got, it's a proper road. In fact, all that area is now built up.
Right.
And there was no real sliced bread there. There was nothing from the UK there. It was all make your own spices, dry them on the roof, and use a pestle and mortar.
Pestle and mortar, yes.
To bang them all. And my mother-in-law used to make all her own spices.
Did you live with your
mother? Yeah, my mother-in-law was in the front of the villa, and we had a little flat at the back, and his brother was upstairs.
Okay, because that is quite common in
very common
Middle Eastern families, isn't it?
We didn't have a kitchen for 4 years, so I had to put up with my mother-in-law's cooking, or we had to use her kitchen, which was very, very basic, very basic. In fact, she sat on a little stool in the middle of the floor. She didn't have a kitchen top at all, and just chopped her vegetables like in her lap almost.
Wow.
Yeah, very, very primitive. Very.
So when did things start to change?
Slowly, up until 1990, they did change. You could see the country was, you know, getting the profits from the oil. But I think the most massive change was after the invasion in 1990, where the influence of America and the UK became apparent, because obviously they helped to free Kuwait all those years ago. And, you know, the shops appeared, you know, from American shops and British shops. They all started to appear, and people could buy, you know, products from different parts of the world. But I had to make everything fresh, because there wasn't anything frozen or, you know. Well, there was a bit, but I mean, it was better to make things fresh.
So did you learn the Middle Eastern cooking?
Yes, I did. But my father-in-law, who was alive for the first 8 or 9 months that I was there, He was a very old man. He was about 115 when he died.
Good grief.
He was a pearl diver, and he used to dive down, and he was actually made blind by the salty water in his eyes, but he used to dive for pearls, so
good grief.
That was his job.
115?
Yeah, I didn't believe that, but when he was actually in the hospital, when he wasn't, you know, he was dying, and I said to one of the doctors, so how old do you think this gentleman is? He said, oh yeah, between 115 and 120. And we found his old passports, and that was like in the 1800s, so you know that he must have been something like that, yeah.
Good grief. What an amazing life.
Yeah, for him it was. Yeah, incredible. He lived in one of those houses right in the beginning, in the start of Kuwait City, made out of, I think that they were made out of rocks from the sea, which were kind of like a coral.
Mm.
They'd harvest those and then build their houses of it.
Wow.
So, yeah, very, very, very primitive, you know.
Very
primitive. Palm leaves woven for the mats. I mean, yeah. I can remember my mother-in-law, she swept her floor. I think to the end, she never ever had a Hoover. She had it was a brush woven out of palm leaves, and you could buy them in the shops like that. And she sorted and cleaned all her rice and got all the weevils out of that by using a mat that was made out of woven palm leaves.
Good grief.
Oh no.
I just can't even get my head around it.
It was all new to me. It was interesting.
Were you ever tempted to run away and come home?
I did. I thought, oh gosh, this is a bit interesting, but I didn't. I don't regret any minute I spent in that part of the world. It was fine, you know. Once I started having children, and I've got three boys, it was fine. No, I've got no regrets. It was good.
How long were you there before you had your first child?
I went there January 1980. My first one was born July 1981.
So pretty soon then?
Yeah. And good job I had boys.
What was that like, having children in such a different environment to the UK?
I was taken to a private hospital, just literally down the road from us, and I was told I was going to get the best treatment, and I wasn't quite sure about what was going to happen with childbirth, but in the end I was gassed out, so I had this gas put on my face, and I remember that. And they I think delivered my first son by forceps. But I was completely out, as in out cold for the whole of the birth. I didn't know he was being born.
Good grief.
Yeah. But that happens is you're actually at the height of wanting to push, that's when this thing comes to your nose and I remember trying to fight it off. I thought, no, I want to do it naturally, but they didn't. They just cover your nose with it and you're out. And all the Kuwaitis think that was amazing. Oh, yes, you go to this hospital, they gas you. You don't feel anything. So, yeah, that's what I was. Gassed.
Good heavens.
And then I had a boy. And I looked at my first son. I said, oh, my goodness, you look like my father. I'm giving birth to my father. But no. It's so strange when you first see this child that's come out of you.
Were all three births like that?
No, my second one was born in the UK because I didn't want to have that kind of birth again. But then there was another hospital where my third one was born, and that was down near Kuwait Oil Company. It was in a place called Ahmadi, and their hospital was full of what I call English nurses or people that were, you know, a bit more Western. And that was a normal birth.
So how many Westerners were there when you got there in 1980? You must have been one of very few.
Yeah, there were a few married to locals, but most of them were there because their husbands were out there contracted to various companies.
So they were married to Brits?
Brits,
yeah. Were there many women married to Arab men?
I didn't realise that in the beginning, but there were, because as I opened my hairdressing business, so I got in contact with those people, and there were. Quite a few.
Were there?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was quite an unusual thing to happen then, wasn't it, really?
It was. I mean, there were some ladies that did that before me, so that, let's say, their children are the generation before my children. But, because all the Kuwaitis were sent out to various parts of the world, definitely the UK, to learn.
Okay.
Engineering and things like that. So
they went to the universities and colleges in London and America. So how did the locals accept you when you first started working in a local Arab hairdresser? How did the women accept? I mean, were they suspicious of you, or were they excited because you were a novelty?
Yes, excited, and because and anything I said went, ah, oh, she's from London, never mind, yes. No, so okay. What she says is the gospel. Oh, yeah.
Was it your first job after leaving hairdressing college?
No, I hadn't, because when I left hairdressing, I worked in Debenhams and other places in the UK, and then when I went out, that was my first job there. I had to do something, yeah. But they did, oh, because this is what we do in London. I said, and in the end, I used that to my, you know, I helped myself.
To your advantage. Yeah,
to my advantage.
Yeah. It gave you the novelty factor and, and the
assumption.
Then I'd
say to
her,
don't do this or have it like this. And then, oh, okay. Oh, in London. It's all about London. Where are you from? London. Yes. It doesn't matter whether you're from up north. If you tell everyone you're from London, that's fine.
Yeah. Centre of the universe. Mm, yes. So how did you go from working in a local hairdresser to starting your own? And was your husband supportive of that?
He was. He did tell me in the beginning that he thought that I should have been a teacher, because he just thought that that's what I should have been. He didn't see how hairdressing would work. But I think he would agree if he, you know, he was here, he'd say, yes, it was very, very good, very, very lucrative, very, very necessary for those people that came to me, because there was a lot of, I had an English salon which had English magazines and English feel to it, and lots of people from there. I mean, most of my clients were expatriates or people married to locals.
Right.
And they would come and find that my salon was a haven for them. They could speak in English, they could read things, and there was nobody there. Their husbands felt okay about dropping them off, because this lady was known that she had an Arabic husband, and so there was respect there. And yeah, I was really, really busy. I had an 18-month waiting list.
Did you 18-month waiting list?
Yeah,
good grief.
People stacking up, because I just couldn't cope, because I only worked for myself, and I called my salon one-to-one.
Right.
So one-to-one was me. Well, like I do it now.
Yeah,
one-to-one.
Yeah.
I didn't want to call it one-to-one now.
Well, no.
I've done it once.
Yeah. You're different.
Yeah.
Different life.
Yeah.
So what did your husband do? Was he an engineer?
He was, yeah. He worked in the refineries. He was making fertiliser out of, chemical fertiliser out of petroleum.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So that's what he was doing. No, he was supportive, and he did buy me bits and pieces for the salon. I think at one stage he commented and said, I think you're earning too much. Probably the same as him. But I was working all hours, God sends. But it fitted around the children, you know. I'd close up shop and go and pick the kids up from playgroup or school, or drop them off at rugby or whatever they were doing. So it did. It worked around me. It was fun.
Perfect.
Mm.
Did you change to Islam?
I think I might have done that in the beginning when I first went, but I didn't realise I did. But I did do a bit of Islam towards the end of our marriage there, because I thought that that would make the difference and I'd get on better with my husband, or I'd understand him more. And I did it for a couple of years.
Okay.
And, yeah.
So he didn't put you under pressure at the beginning to...
No. My in-laws used to say, oh, no, you wear the scarf, you put this on, you put that. And I resisted it. He didn't like some of the clothes I wore, so I'd have to be really careful about what I wore. I had to have myself covered in certain areas, and I couldn't wear trousers. And
oh, really?
Everything had to be baggy, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, no shape or form could
show off the figure.
Yeah.
So you resisted
no
wearing...
No drinking, no pork, nothing like that.
Right, but you resisted wearing the headscarf?
Yeah, I didn't want to... I thought if I do that's it, I'm gone.
Okay.
I'm part of them, and I didn't want to do that. I would lose my identity.
Okay.
And there were some of my colleagues that did do that, and they covered up completely and wore the black cloak which goes over them, and they're British girls. But I tell you, when they came to my salon, they threw it all off and became British for the couple of hours that they were there.
Because it was safe to do so.
Yeah. No one passing by.
So how did people respond and react to you if you were out and about, dressed basically as a Westerner but married to an Arab? How were you treated? Were you treated with respect? Were people dismissive of you? Were they critical of you? Did they expect you to cover yourself up?
I probably think there was a bit of everything that you've mentioned there.
Right.
But the majority, I never felt... they do stare. The Arab men stare. I think everything, you know, they do. They stare at you, but you can be wearing... the black abaya, and they'll still stare at you if you're a woman. That happens, and I think you have to block that out of your mind, otherwise it would drive you up the wall. But you know, everyone I spoke to, if I spoke to them in Arabic, they were really fine about it. No, they were good. There was no problems really there. I didn't find there's any problems there.
It's one of the more liberal Middle Eastern countries, isn't it?
It is, it's fine. Apart from it being dry, which it didn't used to be.
Did it not?
No, it wasn't dry.
Okay.
And they had a normal life, I would have said, up until, I'd say, about the 70s.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what changed? Why did it suddenly...
I think because religion became more important, and of course with, I think, technology, you can pass religion around a bit more, you can... I don't know, it started, oh no, we better not do that, oh, we can't do this. And there was pressures, I think, from, this is my view, from different religious sects, because obviously Islam's got two sects, Sunni and Shia. And I think there was...
Well, it's got three, it's got the Ahmadis as well.
Oh, there you go, I didn't know that. So, yeah, it's a powerful religion, very, very powerful.
Yeah, it is, particularly at the moment. So you left in 2007?
Yes, yes.
What happened?
My marriage broke down, and I thought, I need to go. I need to get out of here. This is not going to change. I didn't like what was going on at home, so I thought, okay, I'm going to go. So I did, and I left it for a few months once I arrived in the UK. It was very scary leaving Kuwait because I had a Kuwaiti passport, and I know that your husband can just tell the authorities that you're... They didn't want you to leave, and he, because on the bottom of the passport was written, she's the wife of, and his name was written at the bottom of the passport. So you do feel like you belong to them, and he could have easily stopped me from leaving, but he didn't. And yeah, it was very hard, very difficult. But yeah, my boys were, I had one of them over here anyway, because he'd finished uni and he was working. I had a... Well, my eldest son was going to get a job, and my youngest son was starting uni in the UK, so we all left, which I'm sure for my ex-husband was a massive shock.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like, well, that's the way it went.
Yeah. Gosh.
Yes. But...
If you hadn't have had children, would you have left earlier?
That I can't tell you. I really have not thought about that at all.
Mm.
It was good. I can't say that I didn't like it though. It was fine, it was all okay, but I did see that as I was leaving 2007, people were becoming very aggressive, very into materialistic things. They changed, they'd got lost their simpleness and were going, you know, being a bit brutal, driving fast and being aggressive, and no, I didn't like that. That wasn't how they were in the beginning. They were nice, gentle folk, and then they became materialistic.
So you haven't been back in the last 9 years?
No.
No. Would you ever go back, do you think?
Well, I don't think I could go back, because be flying on the plane would probably not be good, because I had my cardiac arrest in 2010, which of course stopped me from flying, because I might be prone to blood clots, and that's more than four hours, and I'd have to have a blood thinner, so going back to the Middle East.
Yeah, that's
or flying anywhere
is not a
good
idea.
Idea,
is it?
No.
Definitely not a good
not
idea.
Not a good idea, no.
So you don't regret leaving?
No. No, I don't regret anything.
Good.
Anything in my life I don't regret. Not at all.
It's the best way to be, isn't it? Because it's all an experience, isn't it?
It is.
And whatever we're going through, we can always take the best out of it.
Yeah.
And it's down to our choice.
So.
It's our reaction to things, isn't it, that creates a good or a bad experience, not the experience itself. Amazing. Wow. So you've remarried?
I have. Yes, to my soulmate. He's so right for me. He's the most random person on this planet, but he's my love.
Why is he random?
Because he is. He's just, you know, he doesn't remember sometimes to do the simple things in life, like, you know, brush his teeth, or, I mean, I'm not saying he's dirty, but I mean, he just he's not the same every day. He's completely different, and that's fine for me, because I'm... Whereas my ex-husband was very methodical, he'd do the same things every day in, day out. Would you like a cup of tea? He'd look at the clock. Is it time to have a cup of tea? And my father was like that.
Oh, gosh.
So it's really nice. I don't like, I want to break free. I'm a free spirit. So my husband
You are a
now,
free spirit, definitely.
Yes.
My husband
now is random, so we're both random together.
Yeah. You're not random when you're cutting my hair, thank God. You're
quite
precise when you're doing that.
Not, you're back in my chair.
Well, I can't believe we're nearly up to the 25 minutes. Yeah, it goes in a blink of an eye.
It does,
absolute blink of an eye. Thank you, Frances.
You're so welcome.
You're a dream. I love chatting to you every 6 weeks and come and have my head on.
Oh, you're so welcome.
So So this has been Katie Day with Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.